All right.
Recording now, whenever you're ready.
All right. Hello and welcome again to another episode of Sacktown Talks. Today we have a very special guest, former Assemblymember Mike Gatto, joining us today to talk a little bit about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. Mike, how's it going? Thanks for joining the program.
Well, I'm hanging in there. I hope everyone else is too.
You know, Mike, you know, one thing I love, you know, ever since you've left is following your social media accounts. You know, you're always kind of, I like to consider you kind of a futurist. You know, you're always on there predicting stuff, keeping up with the markets and whatnot. And yet, right when COVID-19 hit a year ago, you were out there prognosticating kind of what you thought was going to happen. And, you know, a lot of it came true. Kind of what gives you this ability to kind of see the future and, you know, kind of be right a lot of the time?
Well, you're very kind. I'm not sure I have any ability. It is nice being out of office. I feel like it frees me to be more of myself on social media. Not like I wasn't before, but you know, when you're in office, you're posting so many pictures of yourself at fish fries and things like that.
Right.
Whereas now that I'm out of office, I feel like I can talk more candidly about topics that are of interest to me. And you know, last January, I flew up to Sacramento, in fact, and I wore a flight on my mask and everyone stared at me like, oh, you're crazy. Right. I'm sorry, I wore a mask on my flight. I think I reversed those words. And everyone stared at me like I was crazy. And I said, oh no, it's coming. It's coming. And so yeah, I have fun. I have fun. And sometimes it's nice to be proven right.
Yeah. And keep those receipts, right?
So exactly. Exactly.
That's my most amazing thing, that you're able to pull up your receipts so easily and kind of see like, look what I said, you know, it's, you pulled one up today from like 2016. I was like, how did he do it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. So kind of, you know, some things you've been on current on, you're always tweeting about the markets. You know, you did a great show with David on kind of GameStop. And one thing,
wait, hold on a second. The other Sacramento podcast.
Exactly. Exactly.
I know you guys are sort of friendly rivals. So it's
our sister podcast. They're political-ish. Yeah. Check it out if you haven't out there. Great, great show. You know, you're always keeping up with the markets. And, you know, one thing that has absolutely exploded this year is Bitcoin. Something that I looked up a chart, I think last year at this time, Bitcoin was trading at $5,000 per coin. And today, as we're recording, it's around $57,000. So obviously something's going on here and kind of, you know, I'd love to talk to you, get your thoughts on this. Is, you know, is this just speculation or is there something more there? So I know you've read up on it, you know, maybe you're not the foremost expert on the field, but you know a lot about this area and markets in general. So I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on it. And maybe you can kind of give us a little background on Bitcoin, what it is, how it started, and, you know, start from there.
Sure. So Bitcoin is the first of the so-called cryptocurrencies, and it's based on a technology called blockchain. And blockchain is not, you know, people talk about it. You know, I'm always amazed and I always kind of chuckle when you're talking to someone from Silicon Valley and they use all this jargon and they make everything so complicated. And that's really unnecessary. I think everybody is fairly familiar with the concept behind how blockchain works, even if they don't know it. And that is, I mean, if you imagine, Jarrett, that you went on vacation for a year, you went on a trip around the world and you came back and someone was in your house and you had to tell everybody, well, no, this is my house. Well, how would you prove that it was your house? Well, there's a recorder of deeds, and the deed recorder would show that your house, you had bought it, you know, a few years ago from John Smith, and John Smith had bought it from Jane Doe, and so on and so forth, all the way back to in California, to the country of Mexico and the King of Spain. You would trace your title all the way back. And you would show that the house had come to your possession, right? Blockchain is really the same concept, except digitally. What they can do is they can show that a series of transactions have occurred by chaining the links together, much like we chain the deeds together and the chain of title. And they can show that, you know, let's say I gave you a dollar, you know, it'll say, you know, Mike to Jarrett, $1. And then so on and so forth, they can trace that dollar as it goes around the whole world. And blockchain technology, which is used to power Bitcoin, basically stands for the premise that if you do this, if you chain all of these transactions together, and you've got thousands, tens of thousands of computers that all keep a ledger. They keep the ledger of that thing. You can think of them as tens of thousands, right, of county recorders that record the deeds, that you will always know that that Bitcoin or that piece of cryptocurrency is valid and that you are the true owner.
And so, you know, basically, when did this begin? Was this like early 2007, 2008, as I recall, when this, you know, first became a thing, and kind of who created it? And, you know, do we know who that person is?
Yeah, so Bitcoin was created during the depths of the last financial crisis. by somebody who we now know was a pseudonym, and he went by the name Satoshi Nakamoto. There is a real Satoshi Nakamoto, but he has said, hey guys, this wasn't me, and he's proven that it wasn't him.
Right.
But there's been much speculation about who created it. It was created by a programmer, and he actually was brilliant, right? I mean, there is so much. I mean, look, I mean, you know, the use case is brilliant. And the first Bitcoin, you know, really, I think went for several tenths of a cent, right? And now it's at $58,000. And this programmer, we'll call him Satoshi, you know, he programmed all these things into it for scarcity. You know, a cryptographic program that is impossible to hack or very difficult to hack. A system that is simple and elegant, yet also complicated enough to make it so that it's mostly counterfeit proof. And you look at all these qualities, and you know, you also look at the fact that if Satoshi Nakamoto were to cash in his Bitcoins, which he has not done, he has not come forth to claim those Bitcoins that he owns. I mean, he owns $40 billion worth of Bitcoin. I have said this, and there's one of my predictions that maybe this will prove to be true, you know, 100 years from now. I actually believe that there's a chance, a 30 or 40% chance, that Bitcoin was created by a governmental actor. It would be fascinating if it came out at some point that it was created by the CIA, you know, to be a honeypot, because in its first years of existence, it was perceived that cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin would be used mostly for shadow transactions. Now it's coming to the mainstream, and I'm not trying to besmirch Bitcoin, not at all. But I think that this is so complicated. It's such an elegantly designed something that it had to be created by somebody with tremendous computing power and tremendous knowledge. To me, that kind of sounds like a state actor. Just like if you remember a few years ago when Iran's nuclear centrifuges were hacked, and it came out that it was a joint collaboration between the German CIA, the Israeli CIA, the Mossad, and the American CIA to hack into Iran's nuclear centrifuges. It wasn't just some kid in a basement. I mean, look, if Satoshi is out there, he's worth $40 billion. He hasn't even come forth and claimed it. So I think that kind of militates also in the favor of it being maybe perhaps a government actor.
You know, and I guess, you know, the world, you know, has had currencies for a long time, whether it was shellfish, whether it was metal coins, and, you know, whether it is the modern monetary policy where we have these, you know, fiat currencies, paper dollars, not backed by anything. So if you talk to a lot of people who are into Bitcoin and into history, you know, they say this is the future of currency. Kind of what are your thoughts on that, about basically Bitcoin, you know, possibly replacing, you know, our modern currencies today?
So that's a wonderful question. I'm glad you asked it. So when you think about money, you know, you typically think about money having certain characteristics. Obviously, before money, it was a barter system. You might have, you know, five coconuts that you wanted to trade me for five bows and arrows, right? But the problem with that is, you know, your coconuts can go bad. I might not need coconuts at the same time that you need bows and arrows. And so you really need money to have some sort of characteristics to really facilitate those transactions. The first characteristic is it has to be something that eases exchange. It's got to be portable. It's got to be recognized. It's got to be something that both you and I trust. You have to have standardized units. You know, your coconuts might weigh 2 pounds one day and they might weigh 1 pound the next, but it's always nice to know what a dollar is or an ounce of gold or something like that. It also has to be relatively stable. You know, time has shown that when money loses its stability, it really makes a society suffer. So, you know, money has to be relatively stable. And then finally, it has to have a quality where it can't be counterfeited too easily. And that these are things that, you know, make the dollar such a great currency in theory, and what made gold so such an important currency. It's really interesting though, because when people talk about the history of money, and when people make fun of people like me who own gold or who still, you know, have a little bit of traditional fondness for gold, you know, people say, well, gold has no inherent value. There's no inherent value to it. You can't do anything with it. At least silver has, you know, industrial applications, but gold has no inherent value. Correct. Gold doesn't really have an inherent value. It's a shiny object. You can't really even make a sword with it, or, you know, make a car with it. But I'll tell you why gold has always been the preferred, for most of world history, it's been the preferred use of money. And that's because nobody can create more of it, right? I mean, it's just that simple. I mean, Kings have tried, alchemists have tried. Nobody can create more of gold. It's very, very scarce. And it's also very small. You know, you can transport a whole lot of wealth in a very small package. That's why gold was so valuable. And by the way, that's one of the critiques on modern fiat currency. And I'm going to tie this to Bitcoin. Modern people have said, you know, the United States Federal Reserve and other central banks have created so much currency out of the air that it's really devalued the cost of a dollar, or the value of a dollar. People usually talk about that. They talk about inflation. I don't believe inflation is the right metric. First of all, if you just talk about inflation, you talk about, you have to understand that inflation is calculated as this basket of goods, right? And they'll say, well, a package of Oreos costs this much more this year as it did last year, or a new suit costs more this year than it did last year. That doesn't tell the whole story. If you look at just inflation, the US dollar has lost 99% of its value in our generation, or maybe my generation. And you think about that just when you talk about with goods, but when you actually talk about it in terms of assets and the ability of purchasing power to buy assets, things like houses and stocks and a college degree, gosh, it's lost like 99.9999% of its value as you've had assets rise up. So there is a perception out there that this fiat currency, this currency that can be printed by governments, that it is been devalued. And that's why people turn toward to things like Bitcoin and gold. There's a perception that Bitcoin, because of its enforced scarcity, will always have a value that central banks cannot somehow devalue.
And I guess, as we're seeing it, we talked, Bitcoin was $5,000 last year. Now it's $57,000. If you, kind of compare it to gold, gold was worth more 12 months ago than it is now. So it's kind of relatively outperforming other kind of assets that are seen to be currency havens. Kind of what do you attribute this kind of meteoric rise in Bitcoin to here recently?
Sure. So I think, it's important. This ties into two things, and I'm going to try to address both. The first is that, should we go back to our conversation and talk about Bitcoin as a currency? Is it really a currency? Is something that appreciates this much, can it really be a store of value? And the answer is no. And I think even Bitcoin's proponents have started to come around to the fact that it's really not a cryptocurrency. It's a crypto asset. Obviously no one wants to have a situation where there's extremely high inflation or extremely high deflation. You don't want to have a situation where you buy a pizza for a Bitcoin the next day and like 6 months later, that pizza is the value of a car. And that's really what we're into, right? I mean, there's a guy, I think, in San Francisco who sold a bar for, I forget how many Bitcoins, but it's like, the person who ended up paying for the bar ended up paying like $60 million for a bar, and the guy who got a tremendous windfall and so on and so forth. So it's really not a store of value in the traditional sense of like a stability, that we assign to the dollar or the euro or something like that, the Japanese yen. The second thing, when you talk about it though, it is more of an asset, a crypto asset, something like gold, where it's a place where when the dollar goes down, it goes up. I would say, yes, gold has gone down a little bit since last year, and oil and other hard assets have gone up a little bit. Bitcoin's meteoric rise, though, can be explained by two things, I think. The first one is that more people are adopting it. There's a lot of people out there who are like, oh, what's this Bitcoin thing? And they're getting excited about it. You have mainstream investment banks now offering it to their clients. So you have people, who wouldn't otherwise buy it, who have a lot of money, who can now access it pretty easily. And then secondly, you really have just seen all assets really go up in the last year. Any trendy asset, whether it's GameStop shares or whether it's, certain stocks like Nvidia, there are dozens and dozens of stocks on the American Stock Exchange that have gone up 400%, 300%, 200%. In one day or one week, let alone in the last year. So, what you're seeing is really just a reflection of the fact that when you print more money and when you offer more money to the public, it's really not that there's more wealth out there. There isn't. It's just that there's more money chasing after the same assets. And whether you view it as the asset price going up or the value of a dollar going down, that's really what I think is the explanation behind Bitcoin's meteoric rise, in addition, of course, to it being adopted by a lot more people.
Kind of earlier you were talking about, the blockchain system that goes along with the Bitcoin. And kind of, when you study Bitcoin, a lot of the experts say this blockchain system is, a system that can kind of change the banking system and change the way we operate. What are some of the companies and some of the technologies that actually is looking into implementing this blockchain system into our, everyday life?
Sure. So there's several of them, right? When I think about the future of blockchain or what some people call altcoins, coins other than Bitcoin, there's really a few different roles that I think they can substitute for the modern world. So one, of course, is that medium of exchange. At some point, I think the world will have some sort of alternative currency that is going to compete with Visa or Venmo, right? You know, you walk to the store, you tap your card, boom, the transaction happens, and you're in or you're out. Right now, I just want to point out that the process for transferring one Bitcoin to another person takes 10 minutes. So it's so complicated from a cryptography standpoint that Bitcoin will never. And again, Bitcoin's biggest proponents are coming around to this, acknowledging this. It will never be a Visa substitute. You'll never be able to go in a store and without having some third party say, oh yeah, I vouch for this guy, which is the same as Visa, right?
Right.
You know, you'll never have that transaction quickness with Bitcoin. And I want to come back to that because I want to talk about the energy consumed and how Bitcoin is made and things like that. The second role that I think these coins will have in the future is a store of value, as we talked about, digital gold, a place that you can somehow have enforced scarcity in this world, as opposed to a dollar, which is enforced profligacy. And the interesting thing about that is in the last couple of weeks, we've seen this tremendous rise in interest in digital scarcity for artworks, basically putting a little piece of technology into a piece of art that basically says, this is the only digital, or this is the original digital copy of this slam dunk footage or this tweet or blah, 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 so that you can create that type of scarcity that a painting would have in the real world. This is the only Mona Lisa. The third role that I think some coins have is a cash substitute. There are a certain number of transactions, whether they are international arms deals or, you know, people who just don't want to pay taxes, or people who are at a garage sale and they just want to pay someone cash and there's no Visa processor, where they need a cash substitute. And I think there's a coin called Monero, which is, my understanding, is the favorite of drug smugglers and arms smugglers, that is looking like it's going to be a cash substitute because it's totally anonymous, or more or less anonymous. And then finally, there will be a fourth category for these coins that's people call DeFi, which is basically this idea that right now it shouldn't be where, you know, Jarrett Blanion wants a loan, Mike Gatto wants a loan. We have to go to a bank. The bank says, well, you've got, investigates us and determines that we've got certain assets and blah, 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 blah. It should be able to be done by a computer algorithm. And this idea that there shouldn't need to be an intermediary to determine that someone is loan worthy or whatever. And I think a lot of those platforms are based on Ethereum or Ether. And so I think there will be a role for maybe four or five coins in the future. But this proliferation of thousands and thousands of coins, you know, 10 new ones coming on every week, I don't think that can continue. I don't think they will hold their value.
Yeah, that's something that I, you know, looking into this, you know, 5-6 years ago was overwhelmed with, was, I guess, the amount of coins. You know, you have Bitcoin Cash, Ethereum, Bitcoin, you know, a few hundred others. And until basically Coinbase came along, it was kind of like, well, what are these? How do you buy one and how do you store it? And how do you know you have it? And kind of, that was like a big learning curve. I guess, can you kind of go through that process a little bit, as far as you know, is, you know, how do you buy a coin? How do you store a coin? And how do you keep it safe?
So that's an excellent question, because it comes down to one word, essentially, which is trust. When you look at a dollar bill, you know, it says, this is backed by the full faith and credit, where it says, you know, this note is good for all notes, or this public and private, I forget the exact language. But we all believe in the dollar. We all believe in it. But when it comes down to it, it's really just an obligation that the Federal Reserve, you know, owes to the bearer. It's really a manifestation of debt from the Federal Reserve to whoever holds it. But we believe that that piece of paper has a value, and it now enables us to transact business. The thing about coins, right, is that they're ephemeral. They exist in the digital world. And there have been some of the exchanges that have been hacked. A few years ago, there was an exchange called Mt. Gox. Mt. Gox was hacked, and everybody who participated lost all of their digital currencies. They lost their Bitcoin. But Bitcoins can be stored in a variety of ways. Some of them can be stored, and it's really interesting how people have stored them. So the Winklevoss twins, who are these big proponents of Bitcoin, my understanding is that, you know, you can have a, you know, 32-digit or 100-digit cryptographic sequence where you have basically a password to access your Bitcoin. And what they do is they will print it out once, rip it up into four pieces, put it at four different safe deposit boxes. That's how they store their Bitcoin. But somewhere, obviously, there is a computer where they can log into it with that chain of keystrokes. Other people can store it on a USB flash drive, right? That's a very transportable way. Of course, you hope nothing ever happens to that flash drive. I've lost a few in my time, right. But most of them are really just stored on exchanges. And the exchanges now have been, you know, the IRS has contacted all the exchanges And you can no longer sign up to buy and sell Bitcoin unless you put in your social security number. And these exchanges, you can think of them as just, you know, stock brokerages for the modern world for things like Bitcoin and other altcoins. You still have to put in your social security number. If you have a capital gain from a sale, you know, buy a Bitcoin at 1,000, sell at 2,000. Uncle Sam's going to get that information. It's really no different in terms of the trust and the storage and everything like that. Some of them have higher security than you logging into your E-Trade account and buying $1,000 worth of IBM. If you sell it at $2,000, well, first of all, you log in and you know it's there, or you kind of know it's there. It's, you know, the digital world. But if you sell it at $2,000, the IRS is going to know that you made a $1,000 profit and you're going to be taxed accordingly.
You know, when we talk about this, about these digital coins and things like that, one thing you brought up was the energy they use, and kind of something Bitcoin mining is something you hear about, people buying servers, you know, plugging them in and hoping to mine a Bitcoin of their own. Can you kind of go into the energy use of Bitcoin and kind of how Bitcoin mining works?
Sure. So Satoshi Nakamoto wanted to make it so that there was that Bitcoin had enforced scarcity. Bitcoin is capped at the number of coins that can issue. And he also wanted to make it where slowly new coins were released to the public, because obviously that's the only way you can get widespread adoption and really get a certain right size amount of coins in circulation. So what he did is he made it so that what have come to become known as miners, they are essentially cryptography validators. They are people who devote their computers, whether it's a chain of laptops or these super high powered servers, to solving the cryptographic problems that enable Bitcoin transactions to be verified. So as I said, you know, you imagine that you've got this chain showing how Bitcoins have been transacted over time. The first one, you know, Satoshi gave them to himself, and then maybe someone else got them. And it comes down to, you know, now Mike gave one to Jarrett, right?
Right.
At some point, that string, that chain is so long, it takes so much computing power to verify it. Because remember, you also have to ping the 20,000 or 50,000 or 100,000 different ledgers that are, you know, keeping this. And then you have to solve the cryptographic code problem. And that takes tremendous, tremendous computing power. Wow. But those people who do that, or those servers who do it, are rewarded with a Bitcoin, or in most cases, a piece of a Bitcoin. And it's a reward for making the system self-containing. You can think about it as, you know, again, you know, it's an imperfect analogy, but Visa card makes 3% of transactions by verifying. They tell the merchant, this really is Mike Gatto. He really does have the credit or the money in his bank to pay for this transaction. That's what this service that people are doing. And because of that, they're getting paid. And but it requires so much energy to do it now, because the chains are so long and the problems are so complex, that it is estimated that just to process these Bitcoin hash transactions requires the same power output as the nation of Finland. And you think about that, it's a people, you know, critics will say it's a lot of wasted energy.
That's pretty amazing. And it's something I never thought about, is I guess as Bitcoin ages and there's more and more transactions, the more and more complicated it gets, I guess the longer time it takes to transact a transaction, the more energy it takes. Is that right?
Yeah. And there are people who talk about ways to get around this. They talk about so-called forks, that you will, you know, take part of the ledger and go this way and make it so that it's a little less processing time, or that you'll have a third party validator. But again, that takes out some of the whole charm of cryptocurrency, which is it's peer-to-peer. It doesn't require a third party validator, but yeah, it does require a tremendous amount of energy. And at some point, you know, maybe the energy needs will go down. Maybe we'll have some amazing, you know, thing. Maybe they'll pass a law, you know, saying that only solar can be used, who knows. But I can tell you right now, it does require a lot of energy. That's one of the criticisms when last week Elon Musk said, you know, you can buy a Tesla with Bitcoin. A lot of mainstream journalists came out and said, that defeats the whole point. You're using a tremendous amount of energy, you know, to get these Bitcoins or to process the transactions. And then you're buying a car that is supposed to reduce our GHG emissions. So there's a little bit of issues with it. And by the way, you know, one thing that I will note is the energy consumption is one of the reasons why I think we should talk about something else, which is what Ray Dalio, the famed investor, said just last week. And here's where I'll be annoying. I had tweeted it a couple of weeks before, and then, you know, he came out at a talk and mentioned this. And I'm sure there's plenty of others who've noted this, which is, if Bitcoin gets too big, if it gets so big, or if Monero gets so big that it's used for all these illicit arms transactions, a government can just shadow ban it, right? I mean, it's really not that hard. I mean, when the government, when the United States wants to, you know, diminish the use of an asset, any asset, they just tax the heck out of it.
Right.
It's as old as our republic. At the very beginning of our republic, the government needed money and it thought that people were drinking too much whiskey. So it taxed the hell out of whiskey. And there was the Whiskey Rebellion and it had to be put down, I want to say by George Washington's army in like the very first days of our republic. And obviously we tax capital gains at one rate, we tax different things, income at another rate, and so on and so forth. It would not be that hard for the government to say, you know, we're going to tax stock gains at 15 or 25%, depending on how long you held it, 15% if it was long-term, 25% if you held it short-term and you're a day trader. But we're going to tax Bitcoin gains at 80%. And if they do that, it would wipe away a lot of the demand for Bitcoin. And that is a fear that I have. That's what, you know, why haven't I put my whole life savings in Bitcoin? For precisely that reason. I think if it gets too big, government will get jealous. And trust me, I know. I've been in government for so long.
You know, I guess that's kind of one of the interesting, you know, conversations around Bitcoin right now. It's this great inflation hedge. You have governments around the world printing trillions of dollars. You know, here in the last year, what we printed $3 trillion, and they're talking about another $3 trillion coming up here in the next few weeks. And you know, there's this talk about, you know, the U.S. dollar is the world reserve currency, but that with all this money printing, you know, how is the U.S. going to keep up with all this debt, and is it vulnerable to losing its reserve status? And could something like Bitcoin or one of these digital technologies kind of take the role of the dollar? Kind of what are some of your thoughts on that, as kind of Bitcoin being this long-term kind of global currency?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a book that a journalist friend of mine gave me called the Bitcoin Standard. And I read it, and it really implies, right, that, you know, right now there was the gold standard and now it's the dollar standard, and that in the future there will be the Bitcoin Standard, what you alluded to. I mean, again, I'm a little skeptical. I mean, the idea of central banks giving away all their ability to stimulate the economy and to create inflation when they need it, create deflation when they need to, and to, you know, fiddle with the controls of the economy. I just cannot imagine governments relinquishing that, central banks relinquishing it, and not taking drastic steps to reduce the adoption of Bitcoin. I think right now, look, it's a pretty, it's not that threatening to the central banks. It's being used as a store of value, something like digital gold. But if any of these, you know, really starts to develop as a world currency that a central bank can't control, again, I think the governments will either tax them out of existence. They could actually make them directly illegal. Some cities have made Bitcoin mining illegal because of the power consumption. But the other thing is, they could also just try to replace it, right? Sweden has talked about this. China has talked about this. And they could just say, you know what? You like digital currency? Great. Here's some digital currency. We're going to now create our own digital currency. I mean, and that starts to become a fascinating conversation, because that starts to look like banning cash. That means that the blockchain, you know, which, where we said every transaction is noted, they would also know every transaction that had ever occurred. It really, the idea of a blockchain-based currency, a digital currency, it is beloved by libertarians, as long as the government has nothing to do with it. But when government has something to do with it, now you're talking about the government knowing about every single transaction. That taxing those transactions, a sales tax or a services tax, would be inescapable. They would know that you did it, and they could just take a little bit away. And also, you would talk about the government being able to ban cash, so you couldn't even buy something at a garage sale and escape income tax on it. So, you know, I mean, again, anything that is hailed as a panacea doesn't usually end up being that. It ends up being something that can be copied or somehow diminished or hurt. And I, you know, I'm one of the people who believes that if this ever gets so big, the governments will just find a way to take it over, or God forbid, mess with it. And they'll take away a lot of the beautiful characteristics that people really love right now.
Yeah. And that's what I think is so funny about this is it was originally adopted by kind of an underworld. And basically, yep. You know, how you explained it is you can track every place that coin has been.
Right.
And usually the underworld likes to operate in cash, right? Because you can't track where that cash came from or where it's going. So kind of, you know, moving to this world, this cashless world, which we've kind of, I guess, experienced this last year, as, you know, we're all living with our digital bank accounts. Lots of places are discouraging cash or asking not to use it because of coronavirus. And we've kind of, you know, are slowly moving towards this cashless world anyways. I guess, you know, from a regulatory perspective, you know, just kind of, as you noted, wouldn't this be the perfect way for a government to kind of tax and keep track on its citizens?
Absolutely. And I think the, you know, like with anything, you know, the state of the art always is competing with, both sides have their own state of the art and they compete to do things. Do I think we'll ever get rid of illicit transactions? Probably not. I mean, there will always be some guy who will, you know, go to some special place and with special computing equipment and use a VPN to get into some place and somehow have some ability. But, you know, I think right now the ability to keep transactions anonymous, even for a coin like Monero, which I've never owned and I don't know anything about, but I've read a lot about, or I'm being serious. I mean, you know, I'm not transacting, you know, these things that I've read it's used for on the internet. But even something like that, I believe, you know, the government's ability to somehow, you know, make things like that illegal and, you know, tax them or control them and substitute it with their own digital currency, that's the rigged risk for all of these coins. And it brings me to another risk, which of course is, you know, I wouldn't be complete about talking about the risk without identifying this. We talked about how money has never really had a value. It's never been a source of value. Yes, silver you could do stuff with. I suppose bronze you could shape into a sword during the Bronze Age and everything like that. But I already acknowledge gold doesn't really have a value. It's always been a shiny object. And certainly that piece of paper in your wallet has no value. It's a piece of paper. And we talked about what really makes money have value. That being said, the one thing we talk about with gold, no one else could make any more of gold. And once it became sort of agreed upon, you know, that nobody could make any, when it became known that it was going to become sort of the currency, people rest assured because nobody can make any more. But the other thing that I would add to that is nobody can add another element to the periodic table, right? Despite, you know, some of the, you know, the creation of higher elements, I'm putting that aside. Nobody can create a new metal in sufficient quantities to be used as a currency. And that's what makes gold and to some degree platinum and silver and, you know, the valuable metals have a value. But anybody can create a coin. If you don't like the way Bitcoin is, I mean, you and I could create a coin. We could call it Lotto coin. We could say we're going to give away one a year. It's going to be really scarce. And we're going to say that it has a value of $10 million. Okay, that's what we're saying. And if enough people adopt it, and that's the irony, if enough people adopt it and they put their trust into this product, then it could supplant Bitcoin or Ether, any of these other coins that are out there. And that's why, you know, when all these new coins come out, I run the other direction. I mean, it feels like there are 1,000 new coins introduced every year. It's probably about that number. And I don't see why everyone who comes out says they built a better mousetrap. I don't see how there's gonna be room for thousands and thousands and thousands of these coins to have value in the long term.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You look at a chart of Bitcoin from, you know, it's beginning to now, and it looks very similar. It's very parabolic to the tulip mania, South Sea bubble, dot-com bubble, kind of putting on your prognosticator's cap. You know, a lot of Bitcoin holders think it's going to be $250,000 here in a few years. Kind of what do you see in the future of Bitcoin in the next year or two?
Gosh, I was afraid you'd ask that. but you know, I'll try to do my best to choose one side and not make some sort of, you know, weaselly prediction. So yeah, you know, you look at these charts and you do notice that Bitcoin has more or less matched the frothiness of the markets in general, or some of the more high profile stocks like Tesla that have rocketed up, you know, with seemingly no respect to the underlying fundamentals. And it does really look like tulip mania or any of the manias. There is a book that I read, a wonderful book called Five Crashes, that talks about the five biggest crashes in the economy and the stock markets in the last 150 years. And it talks about what things had in common. And one of the things that every single one of them had in common is the fact that there was a new technology that not everybody understood that then somehow resulted in people speculating on that new technology and then, you know, creating a crash because there really wasn't that much behind it. The perfect allegory is with the crash of 2000, 2002, everybody thought, well, there's this new thing called the internet. You know, pets.com is going to be worth $1 bazillion. And it was like, okay, people are buying dog treats on pets.com, but it's not really worth $1 bazillion. And so that's an example. Bitcoin would really be the perfect candidate, right? It's a new technology. Not everybody understands it. There's sort of been a mania. So that's one of the candidates for a crash. One of the other things that's fascinating when you look at the charts of Bitcoin and, you know, the mania is some of the other candidates for a crash, or one of the other qualities of a crash, is everybody says it's different this time. This asset is different. You hear that all the time. I mean, you read books from the 1870s and they're talking about how railroads will never crash, and you know they're going to be infinitely worth value, and it's different this time. It's not tulips, blah blah blah, and then railroad stocks crash, and you heard that with everything. I mean, in the year, you know, during 2006, everybody said the prices of houses were going to go up forever, and it's different this time, and then of course house prices crashed. So you hear both of those things with Bitcoin, and that makes me think that in the long term, this type of mania is probably unsustainable. I'll go on record and say, I do believe though, in the short term, that there are so many different funds out there trying to adopt it. Most of your viewers know what an ETF is. It's an exchange traded fund that you can buy on the stock market instantly like a stock. Previously, the Securities and Exchange Commission has rejected creating a Bitcoin fund. But now you have all these players who are saying, we want to create a Bitcoin fund to make it so easy for the average American to buy a Bitcoin and to buy a basket of digital currencies like they can trade a stock instantly, and they can just do it in their E-Trade account. And that's something that the average retiree who messes with stocks, he or she might not know how to go buy Bitcoin on Binance or one of the exchanges, but he knows how to log into his 401k and, you know, buy some stock in IBM. Well, if you make it that easy, so I think in the short term, you are going to see a crazy price increase for Bitcoin. I think you will see it probably touch 100,000 at some point in the near future, just because these massive sources of capital are adopting it. And I'll put an asterisk on that. As long as there's no general depression in the next 6 months, which some people are talking about due to inflation fears and things like that. But then in the long term, in the long, long term, I mean, again, for the reasons we identified, I cannot see it, you know, as long as government starts to get jealous, or as long as some government starts to get jealous of it, and they start to take steps to tax it, or to ban it, or to supplant it, then I don't see how it holds that value. So let's say Bitcoin goes up to $100,000, you know, coin, and somebody, you know, look, my own party, Democrats in Congress say, gosh, people are making crazy money on this. Let's say that if you made these crazy Bitcoin gains, we're going to tax you at 60%. I mean, you'd have the market crash in a day. And let's say the next day, you know, China said, we think too many illicit transactions are occurring on Bitcoin. People are buying things to get around censors. They're not recording their transactions. They're trying to move money out of the country so that they can flee. We're going to ban Bitcoin. Well, again, you'd see a crash in the next day. And then thirdly, of course, as we said, you know, if like Sweden said, we're creating our own Bitcoin and it's going to be backed by Sweden or something like that, you know, right, you'd also see it supplanted gradually. So I think in the short term, yeah, it's going to appreciate significantly. In the long term, governments are going to get jealous. And I hate to say it, but it's probably going to experience a crash like what we saw with all of the other assets.
You know, you had this great thread a couple of weeks ago on Bitcoin. You had 6 points, and you had one commenter kind of chime in, and his analysis was, you know, there's a bunch of rich people investing in Bitcoin, Elon Musk, others. So therefore, since they're doing it, it must be safe. What are your thoughts on this about, you know, basically feeling safe in this investment because other kind of wealthy companies like Tesla and Elon Musk are promoting it, and, you know, therefore it's foolproof?
Yeah. So I remember that tweet well. I remember that comment back very well. And I had two reactions. So what he meant is basically it's going to be too big to fail. You know, government right. will not ban it because there's all these wealthy adopters, whether it's Goldman Sachs creating an ETF or Elon Musk owning it or blah, blah, blah. That was his point. Do I think that there's validity to that? No, of course not. I mean, there's no way. I mean, that's like saying that in 2006, you had all of these hedge funds, which they were, buying up all of this real estate across the country, which they did. And because of that, the housing prices would never come down. Well, newsflash, they did. They crashed. And if you've seen the movie The Big Short, you understand that sometimes it really is the financial, you know, it's the intrusions of the mainstream stock market players that can sometimes create the bubble-like scenario that does precipitate a crash. There's plenty of examples of assets over time that wealthy people have owned that did not stop the government from taxing the heck out of them. I mean, look, people forget that up until the Reagan administration, the tax brackets on income were much higher, and that affected a lot of wealthy people. So I don't buy the necessarily the too big to fail. I do buy that for the short term. I think in the short term, you know, again, the price will probably continue to go up as all this money is poured into it. The most interesting point, though, that I think he might, if you were being charitable to that commentator, how would you interpret his comment? His comment would be that, again, Bitcoin is good. It is good for what it is because of trust. I mean, in our example, we talked about you and I create Lotto coin, and we create only four of them, and we give one away a year, and we say it should, in theory, be worth, you know, $50 million. Well, that's only, people are only going to trust it and want it And it's only going to have a value if people believe in it. And they say, well, it's going to be adopted by a lot of people and blah, blah, blah. That is really what has made Bitcoin have a value. You think about it, we're a really sick species. If you think about it, I mean, this is a digital, this is a bunch of zeros and ones on a computer somewhere, or, you know, 20,000 computer places. And we all believe that it has a value and it's enforced scarcity and so much better than the dollar. And these zeros and ones have gone from being worth, you know, a few hundredths of a cent to $58,000 a coin, you know, this weekend. And that's interesting. And yes, I, you know, people out there are probably saying that's no different than the paper in your wallet. I agree. But it's really fascinating though, because someone, Satoshi Nakamoto or whoever he is or whatever she is or whatever, has created this asset out of thin air. And, you know, it's fascinating because I guess in theory, somebody else could do the same thing.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's the greatest mystery is we don't know where it came from. Or whether any of this is real, right? It's just, we're just all blindly trusting, I guess, this system. Is there anything out there that can truly validate how many coins there are, who has them, and kind of what the supply is?
Yeah, so the way that's programmed, the code itself and the validation system does validate the supply. There are tons of people who have studied this, and I should say, I do believe in the safety and the security of the code that was created and the regime that Bitcoin is. But, you know, that being said, I mean, you know, it is just such a strange behavior if you think about it to, you know, someone created this digital thing, word got out so well, like all of a sudden it was like, it went viral.
Right.
And now it's like people believe in it. And the people who believe in Bitcoin, I mean, that was another thing I tweeted is, you know, if somebody does CrossFit and is a vegan, yeah, and owns Bitcoin, what's the first thing that they raise on a date? I mean, people really, really love their Bitcoin, just like they love to talk about how they're vegans.
That's hilarious. I love that. At a cocktail party, you know, what are you going to talk to Mike about right first?
Hopefully it's not Bitcoin, but we'll see.
Exactly. Well, awesome, Mike. Thank you so much for taking the time and going over this. Fascinating stuff. Can you kind of, I guess, tell us a little bit about what you're doing right now and kind of how to follow you online?
Sure. So, look, I, for people who don't know me, I served 4 terms in the California State Legislature. I was the chair of the Appropriations Committee, which determined, you know, billions in spending every year. But the funnest committee I served on was the Banking and Finance Committee, as I'm sure you can tell, at least to me. I love these issues. They were fascinating. Some of these issues were coming before us even then. And so that was my fun committee, I like to tell people. And I served on that during my entire 7-year tenure. Right now, I'm a public citizen. I get asked a lot, you know, will I come back? And, you know, the answer is maybe. I mean, my boy is still very young. I've got some family issues that I want to deal with in terms of, you know, I mean, as you're aware, my father was murdered 7 years ago now, almost 8 years ago. The crime's still unsolved. I'd love to see that solved before I return to public office. And then thirdly, you know, it's really, right now, I mean, I was always a guy in my time in the legislature where I like to see stuff done. I like to be the guy brokering the compromise between all the different viewpoints, whether they were two parties or just two different viewpoints. And I don't see much compromise in the modern political thing. It's been a plague that I think our country has suffered from since 2016. And so when all those three things change, then maybe I'll consider coming back. But right now I'm an attorney in private practice. I do a lot of media appearances. I'm the state political commentator for a couple Los Angeles TV stations, and I write a whole lot of op-ed columns, and you can always find me bragging about what I say or don't say and debating people on my Twitter account, which is at Mike Gatto.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time, Mike, and we'll love to talk to you again later. We'll see how your prediction turns out.
I hope it's right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Our whole dream is